So, good afternoon, Jai Bim, Namo Buddhaya. Yeah, certainly when Taurenya sent me a message inviting me to give a talk, I jumped at the chance. I was delighted. I thought, I would love to come to Cambridge today and to help to celebrate Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar's birth anniversary. I would love to do it because Dr. Ambedkar is very dear to my heart, as well as to many of our hearts in Sri Ratna and beyond. And also because, as Sanghanath mentioned, I have many old friends here in Cambridge, in particular in this connection, those of my friends from India. I will not name you all. Some of you I haven't seen for a long time. And I feel sorry that I haven't seen more of you because of our lives living at different ends of the country. So here I could come. And giving a talk on the anniversary, on the 126th anniversary, as Sanghanatha said, it reminds me of celebrations of anniversaries in India, Dr. Ambedkar's birth anniversary, the anniversary of his conversion, and the anniversary of his death, which are always very, very big celebrations, or mark, we can't exactly say celebration, the death, but mark very, very, in a very big way in India. And I was casting my mind back to the first time that I visited India, which was in 1983. I was fortunate to coincide with a visit from Bhai Bhante Sangha Rakshita, and I was present on December the 6th, the death anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar, in Dapiti. And that, on that occasion, Bhante Sangha Rakshita gave a talk entitled What Death Reminds Us Of. And also, I was present a couple of weeks later, actually a week later, at Bhaja Retreat Centre. Bhaja, close to the very, very old Buddhist caves between Bombay, Mumbai and Pune. And it was the opening, actually, of the first main building at Bhaja in 1983. And there, Bhante gave a talk called Buddhism in One Word. And one advantage of giving a title like Buddhism in One Word, if you remember one thing from the talk, you remember that word. And I do remember the word. And that word was impermanence. I don't remember anything else about the talk, but I remember that one word. And that talk was followed, I was present about 10 days later in Mumbai, in Worli, actually, where Bhante Sangha Rakshita gave a talk, by far the biggest program. I think there must have been at least 5,000 people present. And there, Bhante Sangha Rakshita gave a talk called Dr. Ambedkar's True Greatness, Buddhism versus Secular Philosophies of the Modern Age. I remember quite a lot about that talk, because in that talk, Bhante talked about Marx, Freud, and Darwin. And I was really amazed at this big crowd in Mumbai. Many of people would not have been very educated in a secular sense, and yet Bhante was talking in quite a some detail about the positive message of Marx, of Freud, and of Darwin, and also the limitations of their thought and of the vision of Dr. Ambedkar, and in particular the vision in this context of Dr. Ambedkar in deciding to convert to Buddhism close to the end of his life, and thereby leading in his life the largest mass conversion in the history of the world, 400,000 or 500,000 over 2 days in just 6 or 7 weeks before, sadly, he died. And then followed by many, many lakhs, many, many millions, crores of Buddhists that have subsequently converted in India following his vision. I also remember giving quite a number of talks myself in India, as Sanghanath mentioned. And I remember particularly, and all of my Indian brothers present today who were order members before they came to Cambridge will remember very well that we were all, there were so many requests to give talks all over, in villages, towns, cities, to mark the various, these important events in Dr. Ambedkar's life, as well as, of course, the Buddha Jayanti, the celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment. And one talk I remember giving in Latur, where unfortunately, in I think 1993, there was a large earthquake. I was living in India, in Pune at the time. I think I was living, some of you might have been in Pune then. Were you, Ratnasagar? There was a huge earthquake and we felt it in Pune. My bed was shaking and so on. And a number of our order members lost relations, actually, and went straight there. And we started, our Indian order started with the help of Karunar Trust that Sanghanath and also Gina, fundraises for, and maybe some others of you, number of hostels for children affected. And I went to give a talk on a birth anniversary. That's why I'm remembering it, because it was a birth anniversary. It was quite a big program, actually. Maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people there. And I remember I chose the title, The Seven Names of Dr. Ambedkar. So I was remembering this talk. I enjoyed giving this talk very much. So the whole talk was on the seven names of Dr. Ambedkar. So I'm not going to give a whole talk on the seven names of Dr. Ambedkar, though I could. But I'm going to either remind you, or for some of you, inform you, the seven names of Dr. Ambedkar. Well, we got two, Dr. and Ambedkar. That's two of his names. But the first, I'm not sure if I'm giving them exactly in the order they're usually given, but I will give them in this order. The first is Bharat Ratna, Jewel of India. And this is, I believe, the highest honour available and can be, was given posthumously, the highest honour that the government of India can give to anybody, any great person. So Dr. Ambedkar, I don't know in what year this was awarded, but he is a Bharat Ratna. And we often say in talks in India, he's a jewel of India, but actually he's a Vishra Ratna. He's a jewel of the world. And this really is the case. And in Sri Ratna, we can fully appreciate that, because we really share and promote an understanding of the significance of Dr. Ambedkar's life, not just for India, not just for those who were followers of him at the time, but his vision is something, well, it had a great influence on Sangharakshita, the founder of this, our community, and his vision continues to inform, educate and inspire our order and movement. And I fully expect that his vision will become more and more known, as it is in India, but also outside of India. And what he had to say is as important today as it has ever been. Now, I don't have time really to talk about this, but One of the main things that we surely can learn from Dr. Ambedkar is the limitation of political activity. And this is of fundamental importance in our world today, and the importance of uniting any kind of political activity with an effective means of changing our hearts and minds in the direction of overcoming greed, hatred and delusion. So Bharat Ratna. Bharat Ratna, Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva. Dr. Ambedkar, if anybody was in recent history, and no doubt there are others one could say this of, one of those people who one can think of as leading a bodhisattva active life, that would surely be Dr. Ambedkar. The way he devoted himself to the service of others, his courage, his independence of mind, his not thinking about his own comfort, his not thinking about his own popularity. So in India, we often give talks about Dr. Ambedkar, for example, relating Dr. Ambedkar's life to the six perfections of a bodhisattva. But no time to go into that. So Bharat Ratna Bodhisattva, doctor. Doctor. So what does that signify? Well, that signifies that he was an educated, cultured man, extraordinarily so, the first person from his downtrodden background to be able to go to the United States of America, to London, to Germany, to further his education. Quite extraordinary achievement, and he used his education to have a sense of history, of a very, very big perspective on history. A sense of the world's religions, which enabled him over a 20-year period examining all the possibilities of different religions, having decided in 1936 that although I was born a Hindu, but I will not die a Hindu. And over 20 years, he really thought about it, he studied from all his knowledge, and he decided on Buddhism. So doctor, Bharat Ratna Bodhisattva Doctor Baba Saheb. So what does that mean? Well, in a way, I don't feel I can say fully, because I wasn't brought up in the culture where it's like second nature, and rightly so, to see Dr. Ambedkar devotedly, lovingly, with great respect, with great gratitude as Baba Saheb, much loved, in a way words can't convey what I've often heard my Indian brothers and sisters, how I've heard them speaking of Dr. Ambedkar. And it always gave me pleasure when I lived in India to speak of Dr. Ambedkar as Baba Saheb. And then the last three names are a bit easier, really, or a bit easier to explain. Bhimrao, Ramji, Ambedkar. So as far as I can... Actually, I must admit my memory is a bit hazy here, but I think Bhim was his childhood name. Is that right? And I think Ramji may have come from his father's name. And Ambedkar was actually slightly changed, because I think his family name was Ambedkar. Ambawadika. And his teacher, one of his primary school teacher or secondary school teacher?
Primary.
Suggested he changed the name. Why was that? Shorter?
Sounds good.
Otherwise, we'd be saying Dr. Ambedkar. So it could have been that. But it's Dr. Ambedkar. So these are the seven names: Bharat Ratna Bodhisattva, Dr. Babasaheb Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. But we don't need to say that all the time. we can just say Baba Saheb. And of course, the greeting in India, certainly amongst all followers of Dr. Ambedkar and those of us familiar, is Jai Bhim. Victory to Bhimrao Ambedkar. So now, coming to today, here we are at the Cambridge Buddhist Centre celebrating Dr. Ambedkar's birth 126 years ago. So, how did this come about? How does it come about that we're in Cambridge, UK, with a mix of British-born, Indian-born, and my guess is born in some other countries, I don't know. Mostly Buddhist, maybe some other visitors who are not Buddhist. How do we come to be here today? That's a really remarkable story. How each of us came here today, well, we have to think about our life and the life of our parents and our grandparents and all the different environmental, social, psychological conditions on us. Each would be telling our life stories. But today I want to weave together, this afternoon, a little bit of a story around Dr. Ambedkar, Sangharakshita, and, believe it or not, Sudhamma, and Dhammadeep, and your families from Gujarat. So who else is here from Gujarat?
Hashida.
And any of your children here?
Man.
Okay. So this is about you, man. This is going to be about you. So how did you come to be here today? That's the question. Because my story starts in April or May 1947. That's 70 years ago. When India was still part of the British Empire. Just. And there was a meeting in Ahmedabad, Gujarat. Ahmedabad being the capital of course, of Gujarat. And there was an All India Dharma Parishad. That means a religious convention lasting several days. And there were representatives from the different religions then extant in India, mostly Hindus, actually, and many, many different kinds of Hindus, from many different sects and so on. And there were also some Sikhs, Muslims. There was one Baha'i present, one or two Christians, and there was one Buddhist. One. And that Buddhist was a 21-year-old Englishman. You've guessed it, it was Sangharakshita. 21 and a half. And he was the only representative at this All India Dharma Parishad convention. And talks, lectures going on. Often people would speak for an hour or two, apparently. And when Sangharakshita, who was not yet Sangharakshita, because he was not yet ordained as a monk in 1947, I'm not even sure that he wasn't a Shramanera, was he, then, in 1947? So, no, he wasn't, because he describes, actually, he was not wearing robes at that time. He was not wearing robes. So he'd been in India after the war. He'd stayed in India. He'd come, for those who don't know, he'd come from Ceylon, Sri Lanka, to India. So when he stood up to speak, maybe he'd been sitting on the stage for 2 or 3 days, probably, and saying nothing, and he was told, don't speak for more than 10 minutes or something like that. But he spoke for 20 or 25 minutes. And He famously, as he's written about in his memoirs, was said, say that Buddhism and Hinduism are the same. Or say that Buddhism is part of Hinduism. But he was sensitive to the situation, but he certainly didn't go so far as to say that, because he didn't think that. So he gave a talk. And afterwards, he stayed on in Ahmedabad, and it was the time of coming up to the Buddha Purnima, the Buddha Purnima, the Vaishakha Purnima, the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, the full moon. And he said to some of his Hindu friends that it would be appropriate, good to celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment in Ahmedabad. And they helped him to organize it, and there was a celebration. And he thinks it was the first time there was a celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment in recent history. In fact, he even says maybe ever. So I don't know to what extent Buddhism actually was active in Gujarat. And he thinks, he writes, he was the only Buddhist at that convention. In fact, somebody else did turn up after 2 or 3 days, also representing Buddhism, and was invited to give a talk about Buddhism. But actually, it turned out they were not Buddhist. They were Hindu. That's good, they wanted to give a talk on Buddhism. But he was the only Buddhist giving a talk on Buddhism. And yeah, he thinks, well, maybe he was the only Buddhist in Gujarat. It's possible. Dharmadeep is nodding. So now we move forward 35 years to 1982. From 1947 to 1982, which actually is exactly 35 years ago, by chance. We find Sangharakshita again in Ahmedabad. Actually, between 1947 and 1982, he had visited Ahmedabad many times. He had done a lot of Dharma work in Gujarat, in Ahmedabad, many times. But, of course, as most of you will know, he came back to England, to London, after 20 years in 1964, and settled permanently in 1967 and started this Triratna Buddhist movement. And in 1982, having started our order here, he was on his second or third tour in India, and he went to Ahmedabad. And this time, there were several thousand Buddhists in Ahmedabad, 35 years later. So, and there was an active Buddhist organization. So, how can that be? So, in order to explain that, I'm going to read from the early on the lecture that Sangharakshita gave in 1982 in Ahmedabad, in the, I think it's called the Jyoti Hall. You know that Jyoti Hall? Yeah, and so talking about the change, he himself in this lecture talks about how when he had come in 1947, there was just himself, but now there's thousands of Buddhists. So he says in this lecture, Sangharakshita, so what is the reason for this change? How has it come about? No doubt there are a number of different reasons. But one reason is clearly the most important of all. Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar's conversion to Buddhism on 14th of October 1956 in Nagpur. On that occasion, he did not embrace Buddhism alone, but along with lakhs of his followers. Since then, there has been a great revival of Buddhism all over India. The center of that revival is, of course, Maharashtra, where there are now more than 30 lakhs of Buddhists, this of course in 1982, and many lakhs of sympathizers. In Maharashtra, there is a lot of enthusiasm for the Dhamma, and a lot of Buddhist activities are going on there. I saw this for myself in the course of my recent tour. Everywhere I went, people wanted to hear the Dhamma and learn how to practice it. But the revival of Buddhism is also taking place in many other parts of India. In Uttar Pradesh, and that's where Taranya comes from, and that's where I first met Taranya. So that is where Aditya, Mani and Aditya, that's how you come to be here. Because Dr. Ambedkar started a revival of Buddhism in India, and it spread to Uttar Pradesh, in Karnataka, in Tamil Nadu, and here in Gujarat. Bantu was in Gujarat, in Ahmedabad. So Bantu says, that is why we are gathered together here tonight. And actually, that is why we are gathered here this afternoon. That's why. So, just a little bit more about how we come to be here. I've already mentioned that Dr. Ambedkar had decided, despite his political, social, educational activities after he came back from the West, that eventually he should choose another religion and that he should encourage others to follow. And then in 1950, Sangharakshita had his first meeting with Dr. Ambedkar. Sanghanath has referred to the connection. It started with a correspondence, actually, and then three meetings. And we can understand how close, even though Dr. Ambedkar, Baba Saheb, and Sangharakshita only met three times, we can appreciate how close the rapport was when we remember that Dr. Ambedkar asked Sangharakshita to conduct the mass conversion. This was his first choice to conduct the mass conversion, which took place in Nagpur on October the 14th, 1956. But Bhante advised to Dr. Ambedkar that rather than asking him, it would be better to ask the senior most Buddhist monk living in India at that time, U Chandramani. The reason being that then the conversions would be taken more seriously by the rest of the Buddhist world. So that's what actually happened. So there was the largest mass conversion of any faith or religion in the history of the world. 400,000 probably on the 14th of October and another 100,000 on the 15th of October. And then many more before Dr. Ambedkar died, 6 weeks later or so, and then many more after. Something else to note, the three refuges that we chanted at the beginning, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, to the Buddha, the Enlightened One, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, and the Sangha, the spiritual community of those following the Buddha. Just before the conversion, Dr. Ambedkar, he had decided he would only take the first two refuges, the Buddha and the Dhamma. And why was that? And this is significant. Because he was disappointed in the bhikshu in the monastic Sangha. He felt they did not live up to what he expected of the Buddha's followers. But again, he had very good advice, this time from U Chandramani, who said, that may be so. You may be disappointed, I'm imagining, he said. But still, it's important that you take the three refuges again. Otherwise, it won't be taken seriously in the Buddhist world. And of course, more than that, there's a reason to have a third refuge, because even if we are ever disappointed by the Sangha refuge, we still need the Sangha refuge. We still need to work to make the Sangha refuge real in the world, whether we go for refuge to the Sangha of enlightened, those who are enlightened or well on the path to enlightenment. We do, actually. That's what we go for refuge to. And, well, actually, that is what we actually go for refuge to anyway. So, I mean, there always is the Sangha of the past. But in terms of the Sangha that we actually participate in, of course, we always need to work to make that more and more worthy of its name. But it's significant that he had that doubt. And also it's significant, very significant, that Tri Ratna has been so effective and successful working in India since it was founded by Lokamitra in 1977-78, 10 years after the founding of our order here, because Tri Ratna, as well as giving a very, very, in India, where 1/3 of our order members, about 600-700 order members are out of our 2,000 order members, where we have such an effective order and community. Not only do we have an effective Sangha that we can offer, we have an effective Sangha that we can offer as well as very, very clear teachings. So, yes, and just one more point here, or maybe two, which is that after the... Yes, that after taking the refuges and precepts and converting Dr. Ambedkar with his wife, he turned to the audience of 4 lakhs of followers and he administered the refuges and precepts to them. And this was a total break from tradition, because sitting on the stage was Uttandramani and other monks. And always the monastics would give the refuges and precepts. And actually I was talking only quite recently with Bhante Sangharakshita about this event. And I said I wondered whether Uttandramani knew in advance that Dr. Ambedkar, after the converting himself, would actually then, as it were, take over and administer the refuges and precepts himself. And I think Bhante, he couldn't say. I don't know whether it's known, but he did. And significantly, the monks on the stage, they respected that. They respected it, probably because they could understand this was so important that Dr. Ambedkar could pass on his inspiration, his vision, directly to those 400,000 people, in a way that started a lineage of going for refuge from Dr. Ambedkar. Obviously, it goes back to the Buddha. And then one other point to make here is after the refuges and precepts were taken by the 400,000 people, Dr. Ambedkar asked them to repeat after him 22 vows. 22 pratignya, which he had written specially for the occasion. And these are published in this wonderful book, which was the first of the 27 volumes of the complete works of Sangharakshita. I bet you've seen it. Dr. Ambedkar and the Revival of Buddhism 1. And this book was published last September. It's the first of the complete works of Sangharakshita. Another 3, some of you will know, were launched last week. And this contains Sangharakshita's book, Ambedkar and Buddhism. It contains 30 lectures, including the lecture that I'm referring to today, that Sangharakshita gave in 1982 in Ahmedabad, which I'm going to come back to in a moment. And this contains also the 22 vows. I'm only just going to read from a few of them, but we can see how strong and important they are for the full realization for those from the background of the background of the outcast position in Hinduism, converting to Buddhism. So the first is, I shall not consider Brahma, Vishnu and Mahesh as gods, nor shall I worship them. So this is a complete break from the old religion. And still today, when there are conversions to Buddhism, definitely from the so-called Dalit background, or even from the scheduled tribe background, or anything like that, or anybody who would recognize Dr. Ambedkar as an inspiration, still these 22 pratigna will be part of the ceremony. And the two, I shall not consider Rama and Krishna as gods, nor shall I worship them. But then, moving on, number seven, I shall not act in a manner violating the principles and teachings of the Buddha. And number 10, I shall endeavour to establish equality. And number 12, I shall practice the 10 paramitas taught by the Buddha. And then, this is very strong, very, very strong. Number 19, no, I'll read number 18. 18, I shall lead my life bringing together the three Buddhist principles of wisdom, morality and compassion. And number 19, we need to remember, I say this because we need to, this is very strong about Hinduism, but we need to remember this is being said by people who have suffered as untouchables. I say this because it is not a slight on Hindus. So I want to say this. I renounce Hinduism, which is detrimental to the fulfillment of human beings and which considers human beings as unequal and degraded, and I embrace the Buddha Dhamma. And then 20, I firmly believe the Dhamma of the Buddha is the Saddhamma. And 21, I believe that I am taking a new birth. And number 22, thus I vow to lead my life according to the Buddha's teachings. So I thought I'd read from that because we can't really understand what Dr. Ambedkar did without also understanding the 22 vows and what led him to feel that those 22 vows needed to be an integral part of the conversion. So now I'm coming to the last part of my talk. In the last part of my talk, I want to come back to that evening in Ahmedabad 35 years ago. And I don't think I have yet mentioned what was the title of Bhante Sangharakshita's talk that evening. The title of the talk is Entering the Stream of the Dhamma. I just find it again in this beautiful book, Entering the Stream of the Dhamma. And I'm going to give you some idea of the gist of this talk. And I'm doing it with the intention that this is a talk for us. The Dhamma is universal. It is outside of time. It is outside of culture. It goes beyond nation. It obviously goes beyond caste. It goes beyond gender. The talk that Sangharakshita gave in Ahmedabad in 1982 is substantially, which is now our Dhamma teaching, our Dharma talk this afternoon in the Cambridge Buddhist Centre. It's the same Dhamma. It's just as alive, just as relevant for all of us. So here in this talk, Bhante, first of all, he talks about the stream, or like the Dhamma is like a river. A river. And in what way is it like a river? Well, a river It has a source, it comes from somewhere, and it goes somewhere. It has a source and it has a goal. So what is the source of the river of the Dhamma? The source of the river of the Dhamma is the Buddha and the Buddha's enlightenment. And where does the river go? Well, strangely enough, it goes to enlightenment. I was reflecting on this. I thought it's quite interesting in a way because it suggests that as a metaphor that enlightenment is outside of space and outside of time. Because the metaphor breaks down. It comes from, the river comes from enlightenment and it goes to enlightenment. And Bhante goes on to say that if the river is not moving, it's not the Dhamma. So that means that if Buddhism is just like a set of ideas, just a set of rituals, a number of ritual objects and so on, it's not a river, it's more like a stagnant pool or a number of puddles or something like that. And Bhante says that if we really enter the stream of the Dhamma, we will always have a sense of progressing. Because the river is always moving gently towards the ocean. There's always a current. It's always a current. So if it's a Dhamma, it's progressive, the water is moving. The Dhamma, the river, is the same river, yet it's changing all the time. So again, it's very, very rich in metaphor. It's the same Dhamma, it's the same basic principles of insight, but it's changing. It's a changing according to the history, the time. Was it now? Was it a century ago? Was it 1,000 years ago? It's changing according to the culture, the geography, the philosophy, the philosophical expression may change, has changed a great deal. The art has changed, the rituals have changed, but it's the same Dhamma. And it has to change. So again, if the river wasn't changing according to the times, according to the particular conditions, a cultural, social, political, again, it wouldn't be the Dhamma River. But still, it is the same river. And then the water of the river, it purifies us. It's an image, it's a symbol of purification. But as we know, the Buddha really emphasized in his own teaching, it's not outward purification. It's not just pouring water on oneself to be richly purified. It's an inward purification to cleanse our minds and hearts of greed, hatred, and delusion. And not just our minds and hearts, but our expression of our minds and hearts through our speech, very, very important, and of course our activity. And then, where does the water come from in a river? Well, it comes from the sky, ultimately. It comes from the rain cloud. That's why we have the famous parable of the rain cloud in the White Lotus Sutra. And it falls equally on everybody. So the Dhamma, it's universal. It's for everybody. So now, in this lecture, Bhante goes on to speak about how we come into relationship with this river, or the stream of the Dhamma. So first of all, we see it. Well, do we see it? We are fortunate if we see it. It's like, following the metaphor, it might be like we're wandering round and round in circles. We're thirsty, we're lost, and we see water glistening in the distance. And we maybe we hear the sound of wild birds, river birds. Maybe we hear the sound of people, children, grown-ups playing in the river. We hear their laughter, we hear their joy, and we're attracted. And this is seeing the river and moving towards it. In our own terms, it could come about in so many different ways. I'll leave it to you to consider how you first came to just become aware that there was this river of Dhamma. And not so easy to find, because a lot of rivers are not the rivers of the Dhamma. And there are a lot of places without any rivers at all. So, first of all, the one who is maybe lost, more aware or less aware that they are lost, moves closer to the river and reaches the bank. Hears the sound of the water. So that's the first thing. So we're fortunate if we... Anybody is fortunate just to see it, but that's not going to be enough just to see it. So in this, the way Bhante is thinking about this river, the next thing is to dip in. Take a dip. Go in the river. And that means maybe putting our toes in or paddling and just sort of seeing, well, how does it feel? You know, like sometimes you dip in and you get out very quickly. Or you think that you just, oh, I won't get in, I'll just like watch others. And actually following that sort of analogy, it might be dipping in, one might decide just to go to an occasional Buddhist class at the Buddhist center, or maybe do a one-day retreat, or somebody might decide just to do meditate once a week or something like that. They just dip in, they just give it a try. And then Bhante says, unfortunately, one may wander away. One of the problems is that our friends may not see the same river that we see. And we may be attracted to the river, but they may say, why are you wasting your time? Or they may even say, that river looks rather dirty to me. Or, so we may need to make our own decision. Even though our friends are not attracted, we will go. Or whatever it may be. But we may wander off and hopefully come back. And so the third stage is, Bhante Sangharakta says, we plunge in. We plunge into the stream. We jump right in. That means, for example, it might be we decide to go on a retreat, a weekend retreat, a week's retreat. A month's retreat or whatever, we might decide to do all kinds of ways or to do all kinds of things to immerse ourselves more in the Dhamma. And this is plunging in. But this is not enough, according to Bhante. The fourth possibility is to not just jump in and cover ourselves, but to swim out to the middle of the stream and abandon ourselves to the stream of the Dhamma. So, it is a really big thing to do, actually. Because at the centre of the stream, the current is very strong. Centre of the river, the current is very strong. And most people would find that quite scary. So if we go out to the middle, we might very quickly decide we better come back in quickly. Or we might start kind of calling out and then take in water into our mouth or something. So it's like resistance, basically. But the stream of the Dharma is the stream that came from enlightenment and goes to enlightenment. So as Bhante says in his talk, If we can give ourselves up, abandon ourselves to the stream of the Dhamma, it can take us all the way to enlightenment. And that is what he says is the real Buddhist. Of course, in a sense, the real Buddhist is simply the one who goes to refuge to Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. But the one who can really abandon themselves to the stream, say, let go of the bank. Go out to the centre, let go. Abandon themselves to the stream of the Dhamma. That is the aim. It's a wonderful thing. Abhante's talk's not quite finished yet, and my talk is not quite finished yet, following him. Because now, briefly, he asks the question, what is it that prevents us abandoning ourselves to the stream? Now, he doesn't have a lot to say here. It's not a lot. This is not... but it's important what he has to say. What is it that causes us to abandon ourselves? And there's three reasons, actually. And here he gives a simile for what many of you will know as the three fetters. The three fetters. So what, first of all, stops us from abandoning ourselves to the stream is that it turns out that there is a rope attached to the by a pole to the bank. And when we go, as we go out to the middle, we see this rope. And because we get scared, we hold on to it. And that rope, Bhante Sangharakshita says, that is the rope of our own self. That's what it is. So we hold on to it. So holding on to it, we can't go with the stream. Then the second thing that happens is that, again, we see the rope, but we can't decide whether to let go of the rope or to hold on to it. Sometimes we think it'd be good to let go. If it's about to let go, then we hold on. Let go, hold on. And that is doubt. That is the fetter of doubt. We don't have faith, we don't have confidence that the stream of the Dhamma will lead to freedom. We're scared. And then the third thing that happens is that this one's quite strange in a way, but it is something that I guess we all might well do. We pretend to let go of the rope. Difficult thing to do, really. Thinking about this, how can you pretend to let go of a rope? Surely you either let go of it or you don't. We can see. I can see if someone's letting go of the rope or not. So I thought the pretense is mostly to ourselves. We fool ourselves. We tell ourselves we're letting go of the rope. No, we're not. This is self-delusion. We're just sort of... yes, it's for whatever reason, we're not actually doing it. I thinking about this, although Bhante doesn't say this in the talk, I thought, in a way, one could extend the analogy. As you go down the stream, there's not just one rope to let go of. You let go of a rope only to find there's another rope to hold on to, and another one, and another one. So you might move down the stream a little bit, but the rope of self is always there. So I don't think it's like just letting go of the rope once. So it means continually we need to let go of that rope, continually we need to overcome doubt, and continually we need to really be so honest with ourselves and others that we really are practicing the Dhamma in order to overcome our greed, our craving, our animosity, our hatred, and our ignorance. We're actually doing that. So now I come to the end of my talk, and it's going to be the end of Sankarachita's talk that evening, 35 years ago, in Ahmedabad, which was 35 years after his first visit to Ahmedabad in 1947. So at the end of this talk, his talk, Sankarachita's talk, which will also be the end of my talk this afternoon, Sankarachita says, "Fortunately, it is now much easier to enter the stream of the Dharma than it used to be. Formerly, it was difficult even to see the stream of the Dhamma. No one knew where it was. It was hidden by piles of sand, and its name had been erased from the map. But now it is quite easy to find, and it is not very difficult at least to take a dip, because now there is a magnificent new ghat leading down to the river of the Dhamma. This ghat is very broad. It has hundreds of steps, and lakhs of people can go down to the river at the same time to bathe in the water and refresh themselves. And who has built this magnificent new ghat? Well, we all know that very well. It was Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar. The name of the ghat is the movement of mass conversion to Buddhism. It is the ghat of the Dhamma Diksha. And there is a date on the ghat, 14th of October 1956. This is why it is now easier to enter the stream of the Dhamma than it used to be. Tonight, we are all sitting on the steps of that great ghat. And I hope that as many of you as possible will dip yourselves in the stream, plunge into it, even abandon yourselves to it. I hope that as many of you as possible will enter the stream of the Dhamma. The ghat is for all. The Dhamma is for all. Buddhism is for all. The stream will not ask you what your colour is or what your caste is. It will not want to know your nationality. It will wash away all those distinctions. The stream of the Dhamma is a stream of Maitri, a stream of Karuna, a stream of Prajna. The stream of the Dhamma has as its source the Buddha, while its goal is the ocean of Nirvana. Let us all therefore enter the stream of the Dhamma. Let us all purify ourselves. Let us all quench our thirst. Let us all grow as human beings. Let us gain supreme wisdom or prajna, limitless maitri and karuna, and absolute vishuddhi or purity. Our lives will then be fulfilled." Jai Bhim.